This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker.
A central Illinois congressman says right on to President Trump's speech threatening to destroy North Korea.
I thought the president's speech was what we needed right now. Clearly, previous administrations have not had successes dealing with North Korea.
Hear from Congressman Rodney Davis, a Republican from Taylorville, plus a look at the proposed McLean County budget and the future of the McLean County Nursing Home. And a GLT news update on the way. This is Sound Ideas on GLT.
Support for the Sound Ideas podcast comes from listener contributions to GLT, with additional support from Country Financial Representative Justin M. Boyd. Information at justinmboyd.com. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. President Donald Trump gave a speech to the United Nations and threatened the existence of North Korea. Trump said, "No nation on earth has an interest in seeing this band of criminals arm itself with nuclear weapons and missiles. The United States has great strength and patience, but if it is forced to defend itself or its allies, we will have no choice but to totally destroy North Korea. Rocket Man is on a suicide mission for himself and for his regime," unquote. This is a further shift away from decades of restrained public diplomacy regarding North Korea. Speaking at a Connect Transit event in Bloomington, Representative Rodney Davis, a Republican, told GLT he supports the tone and substance of the president's speech.
I thought the president's speech was what we needed right now. Clearly, previous administrations have not had successes dealing with North Korea. We can look back to the Clinton administration, where a deal was made to give North Korea access to American dollars, hundreds of millions of American dollars in capital, if they would just stop developing nuclear weapons. We see now that they didn't live up to that end of the bargain. And it was the Clinton administration, the Bush administration, the Obama administration that we've seen nothing but failures in trying to stop a madman like Kim Jong-un from developing a nuclear weapon. So this approach is new. And this approach is probably necessary to be able to send a message to our allies and those who actually trade with North Korea that enough is enough.
But it seems a bit loud, extreme, I don't know, pick it something new and different to actually threaten to obliterate, 35 million people.
Well, the president clearly has a different way of communicating than others before him, and that's part of the reason why I think the American people elected him. They wanted something different. The status quo with North Korea has not and is not working. The Trump administration does not get nearly enough credit for being able to put together two Security Council resolutions and that impart sanctions upon North Korea and those countries who trade with North Korea. That means the Trump administration, through the leadership of the president and also Nikki Haley, got countries like China and Russia to agree for unanimity. These are huge positive steps on the sanctions side, but at this time, what has happened in the past clearly is not working, and this administration is taking a different path.
One of the major challenges to North Korea is getting China on board, as you remarked. How does this level of rhetoric help or hurt that endeavor?
Well, we're going to see. I mean, obviously the carrot and stick approach has not worked with Kim Jong-un. He's firing more frequent missiles, longer range missiles, right over our allies' countries. And at some point, China and Russia, trading partners with North Korea, need to understand that America is very serious. And the fact that they've agreed to implement sanctions against themselves and against North Korea, I think is a very positive step and a huge victory for the administration. And obviously the path they're going down is working on the carrot and stick approach, the sanctions side. And let's hope that Kim Jong-un does not decide to launch a nuclear weapon that he may or may not have right now.
What's the next step after this, then? What what happens after the sanctions take hold, what happens after this level of rhetoric and this speech. Where do we go from here?
The sad part is we can discuss rhetoric here in the United States, but in the end, you're dealing with somebody who I believe is a maniac, mentally unstable, who controls one of the most oppressed, if not the most oppressed country on the globe, and is dead set on being a nuclear power. We don't know what he, as a leader of North Korea, is going to do or is thinking. And frankly, we've taken the steps, the successes through economic sanctions. And we will now look ahead, and I think the next step is going to be enforcing those economic sanctions so countries like China don't decide to disregard them.
How do we convince China to abandon the long evident policy that it suits them to have a North Korean regime there, like the one that is there?
Well, I think China clearly showed with the two votes on the UN Security Council that they may have changed their opinion on North Korea. And I would hope that the successes that the administration has had will lead to some more multilateral discussions with those countries who actually have a relationship with North Korea to find a peaceful end to this process. But then again, as long as Kim Jong-un is in charge, this is a country led by somebody who is a mentally unstable maniac who's dead set, and we've clearly seen this, not following agreements that have been made in the past and wanting completely to be a nuclear power, because what I believe that he believes that's going to, I think that he believes that's going to make him more relevant on the global stage.
There are now discussions about shooting down North Korean missiles with U.S. technology. Is that something you would support or advocate?
Absolutely. I think missile defense technology is something that has been that we need to invest more dollars in, more R&D. We have to stop using our military and our discretionary spending in Washington to decimate our ability to invest in technology that's going to help save lives in the event that a maniac like Kim Jong-un or a terrorist gets access to a nuclear missile. If we have the technology to shoot down missiles, you're darn right I'm going to support it.
But should we do that now as a symbol of what we can do? Should we tip our technological hand, even on missiles that are arguably not aimed at anybody?
You know, those are going to be decisions made by our military leaders and the administration, and I would hope that they would, if that technology exists and they feel they could make a direct hit, I trust that our military leaders and those who are more involved in the strategy will make the right decision on when to use that technology.
You're not going to weigh in on that?
Well, I don't think it's my job as an elected official. I think it was absurd when there were reports of the last administration where the political appointees were trying to make military strategic decisions over the advice of those who are actually professionals in military strategy. And I think we should leave it up to those who are professionals in military strategy to decide when and where to utilize the technology and the technological advantages that we as the United States of America have over many countries, including North Korea.
GOP Congressman Rodney Davis of Taylorville spoke in Bloomington yesterday.
Support for GLT comes from Dr. Matt Fraker and his staff at the Prairie Oak Veterinary Center, protecting the human-companion-animal bond, caring for life of all kinds, and proud supporter of the Parklands Foundation. Details about the Parklands Nature Preserves at 454-8606. This is GLT.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. 3 years ago, ISU President Larry Dietz called for the creation of a new campus center focused on civic engagement. Thursday, that center is officially open for business. The Center for Community Engagement and Service Learning is located right where campus meets Uptown Normal near the Marriott Hotel and Conference Center and CVS. ISU's Interim Executive Director for Civic Engagement, Janet Patterson, tells GLT's Ryan Denham why they created the center and what comes next.
So the intent is that the center will continue to offer for our students those volunteer opportunities that historically were available via the Dean of Students' office, but to continue to grow those. In addition, we are looking to put together opportunities for our community partners, those agencies, both social service, governmental, educational, to learn more about the campus, to see ways in which the campus can interface more with the community, and to build those partnerships. Our third area is to support our faculty who want to introduce into their coursework service opportunities, engagement, community engagement opportunities, and service learning pedagogy.
ISU has had volunteer and service programs for years. People probably have seen Alternative Spring Breaks, American Democracy Project, Bring It Back to Normal, most notably. So are you just kind of folding those into a new center and putting them in one place, or do you expect to actually pursue new initiatives, new programs coming down the pike?
Right. Yes. Well, certainly, again, a continuity of those programs that have been very successful and impactful in our community. And with the staff from the Leadership and Community Connections Unit of the Dean of Students' Office moving into the center this last summer, it really brought together the initiatives to support faculty and the initiatives to support students into one place. But with that said, we're certainly looking to create many more new engagement opportunities. The area that we will probably emphasize the most is working with community agencies in establishing more formalized partnerships and ongoing in nature, to work with them in terms of helping them clearly understand how to interface with the campus and work with our faculty, and in turn, of course, for our faculty to understand the needs and the calendar that community agencies work under. That way, both sides of the formula really understand each other better and therefore serve each other's needs well.
The location of the Center for Community Engagement and Service Learning is physically right where the campus meets Uptown Normal, where town and gown kind of converge. Was that intentional? Like, can you talk to me about the location physically of the center?
Oh, certainly. And yet I'll have to say that it was somewhat serendipitous. As you well know, space on our campus is a prime commodity. The center, where it's located, turned out to be exactly the right place for us in terms of its size and its proximity to the community. We love that when we invite our community partners to come and visit us at the center, that we can easily refer them to Uptown Normal for their parking. Certainly for externals, navigating parking at Illinois State at times can be a challenge, and the fact that we can say to them, well, it's just like you were going to the Marriott or you're going to one of the restaurants in Uptown to shop or to eat, that's just a great way to help them feel very comfortable, I think, about accessing our center.
So what kind of relationship do you want to build ultimately between the center and local agencies, nonprofits, even municipalities?
We're looking to be certain that when we, in fact, are helping our students engage with those agencies, that they are, in fact, addressing the real needs of those agencies. Unfortunately, there's a pattern, and this is not Illinois State specific, but really in the country, of sometimes institutions just dumping their students onto the community in the form of what they term volunteerism, but perhaps at the time that those students show up and are trying to address their needs to get extra credit in a course or to meet some sort of requirement for a registered student organization membership, it really isn't serving the needs of that community or that community agency well. And so our hope is, of course, that we will become more familiar with what it is our agencies need, the times of the years they need it, the capacity they have to have students work with them, and in turn then match them and our faculty courses and our student volunteers in registered student organizations to those real needs.
This is GLT's Sound Ideas. I'm Ryan Denham. We're speaking with Janet Patterson, ISU's Interim Director for Civic Engagement. She's leading the new Center for Community Engagement and Service Learning at ISU. So what are some of the things the center will be involved with this coming academic year?
Well, we're certainly very excited. On October the 13th, we are hosting Dr. Barbara Jacoby from the University of Maryland. Dr. Jacoby has written extensively on the idea of healthy campus and community partnerships, and particularly on the way we engage our coursework and our faculty in those types of experiences in the community. So we are hosting her that day for a workshop. The first session, the plenary session, is open to the entire community, and we welcome them. That starts at 8:45. Later on that day, there'll be a session very much targeted for our faculty and our community agencies to be together in the same space, with Dr. Jacoby facilitating that session. Another session is for those on campus who work with our registered student organizations and in the Division of Student Affairs in developing co-curricular programs, again, with our community agencies to interface and to talk about the needs on both sides. We're also hosting that day a luncheon specifically for our community partners to help them learn about our new center, understand the resources that we're going to be able to provide them, and hopefully really introduce them to this next stage in Illinois State civic engagement work.
At ISU, civic engagement is a core value, right? It's kind of written right into the university's strategic plan. Can you talk a little bit about the history of that, and where is that common for universities to kind of build that and bake that right into to the formal strategic plan that they have? And can you just talk about the history of that a little bit?
Well, it's a wonderful thing that for Illinois State, as you said, this is just a part of our core values. And again, something that what President Dietz was hoping that we would just continue to grow on. Illinois State has engaged in the local and the state and the national communities in many ways for many years. So I don't in any way want to imply that the start of the center is just the beginnings of this engagement. But what we do hope to accomplish through the center is to bring some cohesiveness and some collaborative efforts. Many, many campuses provide opportunities for students to do volunteer work. But we're really looking to ramp that up so that when our students are engaged with agencies in the community and, in fact, are providing this needed volunteer work, many times we hope that it goes beyond kind of the helping hands approach, although that is very critical and necessary, and we can plan to continue those opportunities for students. But what we're really hoping to do is build upon the knowledge and the skills that our students are gaining in the classroom and being able to demonstrate that comprehension of that knowledge and skills through interface with the agencies. If I might give an example, if an agency were, in fact, looking to perhaps do something related to their marketing materials. We have historically been able then to put together that agency with faculty in our graphic design courses, and at times then that coursework has had as an assignment working on a piece that then in turn the agency is be able to perhaps utilize. These are the kind of experiences we hope we are able to provide our students, that application of their classroom knowledge to the benefit of the local community and to address issues in that community.
What about faculty? For those that want to weave this into their classes or maybe they're researching a civic engagement topic, what role will the center play for them?
Well, I'd like to tell all of our faculty that a good first start place is our Center for Teaching, Learning, and Technology, because every summer we offer a course redesign initiative where faculty, in fact, can learn about civic engagement, how to integrate that into their coursework, and the pedagogy of service learning. But once our faculty have been exposed to that experience in terms of course redesign, we would love to work with them in understanding what types of learning outcomes they envision for their students in their coursework and help them brainstorm perhaps ways that those students could demonstrate that while at the same time meeting the need of an agency in the community. We're also interviewing, of course, agencies to learn what those needs are, and the hope is that we become kind of a matchmaking service.
Well, it's been a busy week at ISU here the last week or so. On Friday, there was the groundbreaking at the Bone Student Center and the revitalization project there. Over the weekend, the launch of the $150 million fundraising campaign. So tell me what's coming up Wednesday with the center and your own ribbon cutting.
Well, on Wednesday, September 20th at 2 p.m., we are holding our ribbon cutting ceremony. We're looking forward very much to hearing from one of our students who's been actively engaged with the community and much of her work. Our president and also Representative Dan Brady will be speaking. We hope folks will come out and see the space, learn a little bit more about the center, have some cookies and punch with us, and really begin to meet folks who are also interested in this work and perhaps find or begin some new partnerships.
That's Janet Patterson, ISU's Interim Director for Civic Engagement. She's leading ISU's new Center for Community Engagement and Service Learning. I'm Ryan Denham.
You'll see ISU students affiliated with the new Center for Community Engagement and Service Learning out and about the rest of the month. The center's September service Saturdays continue this week, helping out at the St. Jude Walk and Run to End Childhood Cancer, as well as the Central Illinois Down Syndrome Organization Buddy Walk. Next weekend, students will help with Worldwide Day of Play in Uptown Normal.
Imagine a workplace where a team has failed really badly.
They might be seen as losers, might be seeing themselves as losers.
But instead of getting fired,
we're giving them all bonuses for having ended their project. Hey guys, take a vacation. And when you get back, the world is your oyster. Find some new project to jump into.
I'm Guy Raz. Ideas about failure. That's next time on the TED Radio Hour from NPR. Sundays at 10 a.m. on GLT.
Support for GLT's Sound Ideas comes from Country Financial Representative Justin M. Boyd, helping individuals and families create solid plans for the future through a combination of investment options and life insurance. Information at justinmboyd.com. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. Still to come, a talk with McLean County Board Chair John McIntyre about the nursing home and about the very, very tight budget for next year. Illinois is preparing to launch a pilot program to test out tax credits for donors to private school scholarships. The program served as a bargaining chip drawing Republican support to the education funding reform bill that Governor Bruce Rauner signed last month. Less has been said about how it will actually work. IPR's Jim Meadows takes a closer look.
One person interested in how the private school tax credits will work is Mike Chitty, superintendent of Judah Christian School, a 500-student preschool through high school in Champaign.
Yeah, we're very intrigued by the recent legislation and anxious to learn more about it and hoping to develop protocol policy moving forward in the next few weeks as we learn more about the bill itself.
Chitty says Judah Christian's operating budget already allocates financial aid to help some of its students with tuition. But the school scholarship tax credit program would bring in financial aid from a new source, donors taking advantage of a 75% tax credit. Just 50 miles away, Covington Christian School does something similar, using an Indiana program with a 50% tax credit.
We only have about 6 students that receive this scholarship for this year. Of course, that varies from year to year based on how much money we have to give.
That's Covington Christian principal Justin Wilderman, who says he wants to get better at marketing the program to prospective donors. He says many private schools in his state like to stage small informal gatherings to promote the tax credit program.
They invite key folks from the community to come in and have a meal or have dessert and provide them information about how the scholarship tax credit program works. Once they hear about the tax credit, the benefits that they would receive, that's usually enough to convince most people to give something.
In Indiana, as it will be in Illinois, the money raised does not go directly to the school, but to a scholarship-granting organization. SGOs are nonprofits sanctioned by the state to take donations through the tax credit program and make sure they're handed out properly. The Sagamore Institute, an Indianapolis-based think tank, runs SGOs for Covington Christian and dozens of other private schools in Indiana. Laurel Christensen directs Sagamore Scholarship Program.
And we receive those donations and process those. We send in a notification to the Department of Revenue in Indiana asking for a tax credit certification number.
That certification ensures a 50% tax credit for the donor and starts the process of getting the money to a private school, which can then allocate it to students. Christensen notes that Indiana rules make sure the scholarships go to middle and lower income families. To qualify, a family of four must make no more than about $94,000 a year.
That's what appeals to me about these legislations, personally. I sent both my kids to private schools, but I was a single mom and I really had to stretch. It's fantastic that people with lower incomes do have the opportunity to choose.
Christensen says Illinois' rules look a little more cumbersome than Indiana's, but they also favor households with lower incomes, with an upper income cutoff level similar to Indiana's. University of Illinois accounting professor John Davis reviewed the Illinois program as interim director at the Institute of Government and Public Affairs. He says the rules prioritize various groups for consideration. Students already in the program get top priority in level one.
Level two priority goes to students with annual incomes less than 185% of the poverty level. Well, that's like $34,000. So there's a particular focus on relatively low income taxpayers.
The Illinois and Indiana programs have a lot in common, but there's also a big important difference. Indiana private schools benefit not just from scholarship tax credits, but from state-funded school vouchers. Illinois does not have vouchers, although critics have used the V word on occasion to attack the school tax credits. Those opponents worry that the tax credits are just the first step in a process to take tax money from Illinois public schools. Just as supporters see it as a first step in giving parents a wider choice for their children's education. I'm Jim Meadows.
This is Sound Ideas on 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org. GLT's next travel adventure puts the spotlight on London in September of 2018. See the Tower of London, Buckingham Palace, Westminster Abbey, Big Ben, and St. Paul's Cathedral. Ride the London Underground, known as the Tube. Take a privately led walking tour of Oxford. Have dinner in a traditional English pub and visit Churchill's birthplace. Attend a no-obligation informational meeting on October 12th. Register to attend at WGLT.org. This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. McLean County government will cut close to 30 positions if the draft budget gains approval. All of the major departments will lose jobs, according to County Administrator Bill Wasson's presentation of the spending plan. Taxes will be flat, spending will be down, there won't be any pay raises, and still the county is looking at further internal consolidation, things like merging the treasurer and accounts payable operations. Also in question is the longer-term commitment to the county nursing home, an aging facility that continues to shrink in use and revenue. In this conversation with County Board Chair John McIntyre, he acknowledges it is as ugly a budget as has come along for some years. Is there any sign that this aggressive response in cutting nearly 30 full-time positions will right the ship into something sustainable, or will the county face this sort of pressure for several years?
We think that we're projecting that if we don't take certain measures right now with our budgeting process, that we'll find ourselves in worse shape in years to come. Pretty much, as you know, local governments are victims of the state budget as well at times on some of the mandates and things that come down to us. We have no place where we can pass anything down, any of our costs down to anyone else other than to try to adjust and work within our own organization. And so there are some drastic moves. We're hoping that some of them will not be damaging to individual employees as much as is in fact we can find a way to, by the process of not only reorganizing some of our services and departments, but also offering a retirement option that is both manageable and in some ways could be positive to some of our employees as well.
What are you going to reorganize?
Well, some of our departments that have two and three members or four members, if there is a possibility, any possibility, to maybe supervise some of those departments, put some administrative responsibilities and combine some of those in what we do and still function. And that's kind of been something that's been kind of prevalent in the last few years. We always take a look at that. We don't want to add unnecessary staff, but also we have to be very conscious of the fact that we have to provide services for the community. This budget is probably going to impact in ways that might be not so noticeable, but maybe in some service things there might be a longer line at different places to get a license or a fee or pay this and that in some of our buildings here downtown. But we'll continue to work and see what we can do so that we're functioning and very efficient as well.
One of the big losses of revenue is in the nursing home, about a $1.2 million diminishment. Now, County Administrator Bill Wasson says that the staff has already been reduced by 17, 18 people, so that's relatively budget neutral. But the facility is aging. It's built in the 1970s to different standards and different expectations, shared bathrooms and showers, for one thing. And that's not the expectation anymore. Is the nursing home sustainable as a viable concern in the future?
Well, I want to be honest with you. It's a very difficult thing for us to deal with right now. And what you just said, Charlie, is very true throughout the nursing home and long-term care industries. The differences and the accommodations and amenities of what people expect, the differences in private pay, and us trying to keep a cost containment so that some people can come in who cannot afford as much, and also trying to take advantage of what Medicaid there is and the Medicaid payments and arrears and function from that way. A lot of the nursing homes would like to have very little Medicaid, and some have no beds as such, and so that we're kind of, we're straddling the fence and taking a look at that because we have to provide a place for some people to do that. I mean, this has historically been an issue. Even way back before there were very few nursing homes, and the poor house type, the poor farm thing was for people that didn't have anything and they still needed care. But on the other hand, our facility, as you said, Charlie, has semi-private rooms that share one bathroom between two rooms. And that's just something that's kind of a thing now of the past. Most nursing homes, and many of them, are trying to even go to private rooms, and some do have private rooms and private pay. And obviously private pay is much more profitable to run a business. A nursing home is a business, but also we have to consider quality of life and services for people in our community. So we're going to have to work through that. I think we're going to need to talk, and we were just talking prior to the meeting this morning about bringing in some nursing home owners and administrators who are in the business and sitting down with them and taking a look at it. There's an increased demand for nursing homes because people are living longer. And so as a result, we're having more competition for nursing homes. And so that's going to be interesting to see how that affects the overall industry within this county I'm talking about.
The majority of the census at the nursing home is Medicaid patients right now. And Medicaid reimbursement rates are going down. And as you mentioned, the reimbursements are often late, which leaves the county to float it. So the question is, do you want to be in that business? And the argument for it is that the county should have some expectation that they are going to care for the elderly of the community who cannot care for themselves and who are not able to afford to care for themselves. On the other side, a new facility would be a huge expenditure on the order of an entirely new jail. Mm-hmm. So when does this conversation happen and how should it be structured?
I think the conversation is going to have to happen fairly quickly because of the financial situation out there, which it gradually has increased. Let's go back for a minute. We have made some reductions in staff at times as needed to be because of the lower number of people that are out there as residents. That can change. You know, the business can wave back and forth, and maybe that we'll see some fluctuation there. But what we have to do is not have money that's going down the drain. Unfortunately, there's jobs as well that are involved with that, and the nursing home business has quite an attrition rate especially with CNAs, and it's very difficult to find RNs because of other competitive salaries that are offered with hospitals and other types of medical facilities. So we're going to have to deal with that. Now, to answer your question about going and building, some counties have done that, and there are counties adjacent to us who have really struggled. And to the point where they put a lot of money into building a new facility and still found that they were not operating with a profit and operating at extreme losses. And to the point where many counties have closed their nursing homes. That is a difficult thing because we do want to serve our citizens as well. And so we've got a real tough task ahead of us, and that is just one project that we've kind of taken a look at, and it's going to come back every year with our budget situation as well. So we need to plan ahead and develop some kind of a capital improvement plan or decide exactly where we're going to go with that. The nursing home picture, as I said, the industry picture keeps changing, and the competition is changing right now. And the amount of Medicaid beds provided that are even available in the county is going down. And so where do we go with that? And so we'll get some consulting in different ways and see what we can come up with that makes any kind of an idea. And then there's going to become a time where we're going to have to decide just exactly what we can provide still for our citizens.
Is this a two-year decision process, a three-year decision process? What is in your mind for having the public conversation, having the consultants, and then finally having the county board go through its ordinary committee process?
With our budgeting situation like it is this year, as you've just seen, I don't know that it can be a long-term process. I think we're going to have to get on it right away. And so I can't give you an answer on that. I wish I knew. But I do know that we have to take a very professional stance and look at it. We have to look at it from a business standpoint as well and see what options are available. Maybe some things will come down the road that will change. Maybe some changes in Medicaid or health care. But we cannot plan that way. So it's going to become an ongoing process, and it can't be more than 3 years for sure. We have to deal with these type of things. The longer we put it off, and the more that we're having money that we're operating in a negative, obviously, like any business, we cannot do that. So we'll be working on it.
That negative is about $1.2 million a year, as I understand from the budget presentation. Mm-hmm. It sounds, though, that with your citing the experience of other counties that have built new nursing homes that are still experiencing difficulty, that you may not have made up your mind, but you're extremely skeptical of going for a new facility. Is that a fair characterization?
I think with our 20-member board, that what feedback I've gotten so far is that, yes, there is some skepticism to that. Maybe we were looking at alternatives. I went out there and took a look at it because at one time I was chairman of a property committee that did a renovation of a nursing home here in town and what possibilities there were. Our situation, the structure of that building doesn't lend itself to us making major renovations and still make it conducive to operating a business and keeping our capacity at a certain level. Like you said, the majority of our beds are Medicaid type, but we may have to just focus on a certain need that our community has and has to be all like that. And we have to dedicate our services and see what we can allow through funding that we can absorb if we have to. So we're going to be divided on this, and I think the best thing we can do right now is get as much possible information as we can and see what helps us make a determination.
There is the Sugar Creek Alzheimer's unit in Normal. Another Alzheimer's facility is either open or set to open soon on the far east side. And yet one of the items for discussion was exploring an Alzheimer's unit for the nursing home to try to boost the census and some revenue. Is that a real option, or is it just a hope?
That's a trend, and I think that all long-term care facilities are trying to become, if I could use a worn-out term, full service. I know Westminster's looking at putting in a memory-type center as well. For years, you know, some long-term care residential facilities had independent living, and then they had assisted living facilities with part nursing available, and then their nursing home. What happens is it's become a dilemma in our society that a facility that houses what we call, nursing care, pretty much skilled nursing care facility, where there are skilled nursing available on site, has found that it's very difficult if someone develops a certain level of dementia or Alzheimer's to keep them there. And so that's why such facilities as Sugar Creek has sprung up, because that is primarily focused on that. To do that and then add that dimension to keep someone there and provide that service may not necessarily mean that we're going to raise the capacity as much as we think. And be honest with you, because many other places are doing the same thing right now.
So what's the timeline for making that judgment about its viability? The viability of the Alzheimer's idea.
It's going to take us bringing in some people who deal with the industry and deal with this. And I think we have some people in this community that will help us in providing information. And then we're going to have to maybe get some consulting firm to come in and help us a little bit as well. I hate to use the word consulting because that's money, and we're looking at a budget right now where we don't have that. But we are going to definitely have to make a decision on where we go with that. We definitely don't want to add and build, and then it becomes self-defeating.
McLean County Board Chair John McIntyre says he estimates not much of the nursing home policy conversation will happen before next spring. This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. Consider your yard to be a kind of canvas in need of color and start planning now to add the right plants that will make a splashy impact every autumn. Patrick Murphy has more on this edition of GLT's Grow.
Spring and summer may hog all the headlines, but autumn has a lot to offer color-wise. I'm Laura Kennedy, and this is GLT's Grow, your source for practical gardening advice from our expert in the field. From the Illinois State University School of Biological Sciences and curator of the Fell Arboretum, it's Patrick Murphy. Hello, Murph.
Thanks for having me, Laura.
Today on GLT's Grow, choosing plants for spectacular fall color. And that sounds like a lot of fun.
Fall color is always such a great thing to enjoy. And it's a kind of a marker in time of other things. Harvest is coming up.
Mm-hmm.
And football season's underway. Jacket weather's right around the corner.
Love it.
I haven't met anybody that doesn't like those things.
Right.
And the fall weather for our design friends, it's also an opportunity to, test your muscles and see how well your plans have worked out. Just like with flowers, we've talked about flower colors, colors in the landscape in general. Fall colors are best appreciated when they're organized in colonies, so light groupings. Also when they're in contrasting groupings, so two different sets of plants, maybe a coarse plant. A coarse plant with large, say, ridged leaves, like, say, an oak leaf hydrangea, with a fine textured plant or a contrasting color in front of it, like maybe some bunny grass.
Bunny grass?
Bunny grass, yeah.
That sounds adorable.
And also, too, our background colors have a lot to do with how our eye picks up these fall colors.
Now, what do you mean by background colors?
Well, so when we go for a drive, if you've been lucky enough in your life to go for a drive in Vermont to look at the fall colors, the background is just a little bit of conifers that are mixed in and the color of the roadways. So even in photographs of the fall colors, the roadways look beautiful, in my opinion.
Yes.
The asphalt belt with the yellow lines, throttle party time.
Uh-huh.
Everybody likes that look, but it's the background color that makes all that stuff stand out so much.
Gotcha.
So you can enhance the background colors and consider that when you're painting your home or decorating or preparing the facade for a business. when there are trees and landscaping present, all those colors can complement each other.
So if I had a maple tree that turns a brilliant red in the autumn, what would be a good one for that?
I don't want to oversimplify it, but light colors oftentimes give us lots of reflective light.
Uh-huh.
So, and they can kind of brighten up those colors that you mentioned, the reds, oranges, and yellows.
Right.
But if you have a dark color, it's a completely different deal where there's less reflective light and it more emphasizes the actual specimen or the source of the color.
Okay.
So there's less of that color bouncing around. The light-colored background with those red leaves,
mm-hmm.
that's a high energy.
Yeah.
Okay, and then the dark-colored background against the same, that's more of a cool presentation.
Okay.
Temperature-wise.
Right.
Not Fonzie-wise.
Okay. You're listening to GLT's Grow, our weekly gardening show for those who like to get their hands dirty. And this week, we are planting for fall color.
So evergreens are color.
Right.
Green is a color.
That's right.
But a lot of ornamental conifers in the landscape take on a duller green color during the winter months.
Okay.
And during the fall. But during the end of the growing season in the fall, they're a nice space holder between the colored foliage that we all love.
What are some of your favorite trees that give us great, deciduous trees that give us great color in the fall?
Sure, and I want to know what yours are too, Laura, but I love black gums, Tupelo black gums.
Yeah, me too.
And that's just a cool tree. The leaf has an unusual shape, and if you love red, that's the one that you're looking for. And sugar maple, that's very noteworthy because mm-hmm. you get kind of a range of colors, usually in the orange, but you can get anywhere from the salmony pinks to orange all the way to a late fade of a yellowy orange color. Quaking aspens, I
yes.
like those because the movement, you know, it's like a glistening tree in the distance.
Yeah, it's not just the color, it's the way the leaves move when the wind is blowing through them, and it just sort of like ups the ante.
And it still possesses that when the leaves turn from a green and gray combo to a yellow and white combo on the quaking. So you get a different quake. And also, too, some of those leaves are starting to fade away, so you see that silvery white gray-colored trunk in there.
Mm-hmm.
That's part of the fall color palette, too. October Glory Maple is a type of red maple cultivar, and it is noteworthy for having lower branches, which I think is a neat look on a tree when
yeah.
it's in the right place. But orange is a really great fall color that I'm partial to, so I love that. And oaks, and I have three little exclamation points next to that in my notes because everyone doesn't love oaks the same way, but oaks have everything when it comes to fall color. You can get reds, oranges, and yellows from your various regional oaks, but you also get the brown paper bag leaf that hangs on later.
Mm-hmm.
The sound is very enjoyable if you don't care for that kind of tattered leaf look on there.
Mm-hmm.
What about you, Laura?
We used to have a burning bush, what was called a burning bush.
Yeah.
And it would turn, it was a great green in the summer, and it would turn a really gorgeous scarlet in the fall, which
yes.
is, I guess, how it got its nickname, burning bush. I'm sorry, I don't know the Latin name for
That's winged euonymus.
Ooh.
And burning bush is in my list of favorite shrubs, along with witch hazel, which gives us a great yellow on a kind of a spearhead-shaped leaf.
You know, that's great because witch hazel gives us great color in the spring, and then it turns around and does it in the fall, too.
Yeah, and then they still have a great skeleton, too. They have great winter character when all that show is finished. You still get something from them in the winter.
Great architecture.
Viburnums, and I already mentioned oak leaf hydrangeas. Viburnums, you get wine colors. You know, you get these purpley reds, but you get the oranges and yellows as well because there are lots of viburnums to choose from, so you can kind of keep that in mind as we are talking about contrasting groupings. You know, what are you going to get to contrast your orange? Well, how about some purple?
That would
right?
be so cool.
Yeah, yeah. And on the ground, at the ground level, you know, so from waist level down, you've got tiger eye sumac. It's a really popular container plant.
Uh-huh.
They are hardy in the Midwest, but it has great yellow color with a real coarse texture. Lots of sedum have good vegetative and flower fall color. Japanese bloodgrass has.
Is that easy to find? I've never heard of it before.
It's been around for a while.
Okay.
And it spreads like the wind, so you should have some boundaries if you incorporate it into your garden. But it is a neat grass that has a pointy little tip, kind of a canoe-shaped blade. and the tips look like they've been dipped in blood. So they're kind of dark green on the bottom, and I guess that would be fitting for a Halloween landscape,
yeah,
perhaps, right?
What a great idea.
And I also wanted to mention purple fountain grass. There are cultivars of fountain grass that the seed head and the frond on the end is purple.
Mm-hmm.
And that all happens in the fall.
Is that an annual?
Well, it depends on where you live.
That's
here in the
right.
Midwest, it would function as a perennial.
Okay.
But a little further north, that might be a challenge. But, boy, they're hardy way up north also. Sometimes the cultivars lack a little bit of hardiness, but I think these are just fine. Those are kind of my favorites there. I know there are lots of other favorites. I thought of some new landscaping here at ISU.
Mm-hmm.
We have a perennial called Bergenia that's in there that has great red to pink fall color at
uh-huh.
the ground.
Red to pink.
And then we have to talk about, too, the plants that have berries. That's in the fall palette, too. Our hawthorns, our coral, berry, things like that.
Okay. And hollies.
Hollies, for sure.
Absolutely. Well, some great suggestions there, Murph, for some beautiful, spectacular fall color. Well, next week on GLT's Grow, winter is coming. So let's make that backyard a haven for visiting wildlife. So we're going to be doing that next week on
okay.
GLT's Grow. If you've got a gardening question, a problem you'd like Murph to take on, just go to our website, wglt.org/grow, fill in the form, and send it to us. Thank you ever so much. That is wglt.org/grow.
You can download the Grow podcast weekly at iTunes or WGLT.org. This is WGLT Normal, a service of Illinois State University. Our website is also where you can find the full Sound Ideas podcast and individual stories and interviews from Laura Kennedy and Ryan Denham. Let us know what you think of Sound Ideas. Post comments at facebook.com/WGLTFM. I'm Charlie Schlenker. This is Bloomington Normal's Public Media, 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org.